One is in place. I'll ask our marshal to call the next case for consideration.
Case number A231597, McLaughlin Detroit Lakes LLC versus Franklin Outdoor Advertising Company.
Thank you and good morning, Council. We are happy to have you here in our Zoom platform today. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your case in chief. 5 minutes will be reserved to appellant counsel for a rebuttal if you choose to utilize that. Our marshal, Joe Tarand, has the timekeeper going, and you should be able to see that effectively on your screens. I want to remind you also to please state your name and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of before beginning your arguments. And if there's any problem with technology, as there was before we started, please either speak up or raise your hand. Otherwise, keep your microphones muted. With that said, appellant counsel, you have the floor.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Christina Rick Lucas. I'm an attorney with Winthrop & Weinstein. I'm here on behalf of appellant Franklin Outdoor Advertising. In this appeal, Franklin seeks reversal of the judgment entered by the district court, which was based on several fundamental errors of law, including one, the law related to bona fide purchasers, two, the law regarding the availability of specific performance and waiver of rights of first refusal, three, the application of the doctrines of collateral estoppel and res judicata, and four, the law and facts relating to Franklin's claim for tortious interference with contract. First, the issue of whether McLaughlin was a bona fide purchaser is essential to all of the other issues in this appeal because it establishes the party's respective rights to the property. The burden is on McLaughlin to demonstrate that it.
I hate to interrupt you so early into your argument, Ms. Lucas, but on the counterclaim, if we determine that res judicata would apply or collateral estoppel based on the action against the Verbergs, doesn't that mean we don't need to determine bona fide purchaser?
If this court determines that res judicata or collateral estoppel applies, then yes, Your Honor, I would agree that you do not need to determine bona fide purchaser status. Of course, we do not believe either doctrine applies here for the reasons that we cited in our brief and for reasons I will discuss later in this argument. However, the whether or not Franklin or McLaughlin is entitled to the property is dependent on whether or not McLaughlin was a bona fide purchaser.
It's your argument, but as I've indicated, and as I'm asking you, if we reach that threshold determination, I think that's very important for you to show us a roadmap on how we don't get there on either the collateral estoppel or the res judicata. It just seems funny to me, that's not the word I want, but I'll use it anyway, that the Verberg lawsuit did not include or address or overlap with what's going on now. It's your case, you can argue it which way you want, but I need you to understand the importance of that, at least from my perspective, not speaking for my panel mates.
If Your Honor would like me to start with the collateral estoppel and res judicata argument, I certainly can do so. I was planning to focus on one of the factors in today's argument because I think it is really dispositive of the res judicata and collateral estoppel factor. Res judicata and collateral estoppel doctrines. As you know, in order to apply either doctrine, each requires a demonstration of four factors, and all four factors must be demonstrated. The doctrines share several factors, one of which is that there was a final judgment on the merits. And as Your Honor pointed out, whether or not the Verberg settlement did operate as a final judgment on the merits in the claims in this case. As explained in the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Henschel v. Smith, whether a settlement agreement and resulting consent judgment acts to bar a subsequent action depends on the party's intent as expressed in the agreement. Accordingly, the party's intent in entering into the Verberg settlement is the critical inquiry here. The party's intention to preserve Franklin's claims against McLaughlin was clearly expressed in the language of the agreement. The release was limited to the Verbergs and their employees, agents, attorneys, accountants, and insurers. The release did not encompass McLaughlin. McLaughlin was not a party to that agreement. And paragraph 4 of the settlement agreement stated, quote, the parties agree that nothing in this agreement shall be construed as waiving, preventing, or limiting Franklin's recovery under its counterclaims in the lawsuit it is currently litigating against McLaughlin's in Becker County, end quote. There could hardly have been a more clear expression of the party's intent to preserve Franklin's claims against McLaughlin. This is squarely analogous to the Henschel case, which similarly involved a settlement agreement that expressly preserved claims against a defendant in a separate action. The Minnesota Supreme Court there concluded that the language in the settlement agreement demonstrated that it was not intended to preclude the separate action, and therefore the Supreme Court reversed the dismissal of the separate action on res judicata grounds. Importantly, the court noted the policy behind this rule, that the law favors settlements, and if parties could not settle one claim out of court without fear it would be used against them in other suits, then many settlements would not be made. The Henschel decision controls here, and likewise, the court must reverse the district court's decision that Franklin's action against McLaughlin is barred by res judicata and collateral estoppel. I do believe that factor is dispositive of those issues. However, if your honors would like me to discuss any of the other factors, I'd be happy to do so. I think we did cover them quite thoroughly in our briefs. Getting back to the issue of the bona fide purchaser status, as I had started to say, the burden is on McLaughlin to demonstrate that it is a bona fide purchaser, and it cannot meet this burden here because it's undisputed that Franklin had a valid and enforceable right of first refusal on the property. It's undisputed that McLaughlin had constructive notice of that right of first refusal because Franklin had recorded its lease containing the right of first refusal more than 15 years before McLaughlin purchased the property. It's also undisputed that McLaughlin had actual notice because it received a copy of the lease via email approximately 6 weeks before the closing of the sale on the property. The district court actually recognized that these facts were undisputed, yet still failed to correctly apply the law.
Can I ask where was the lease recorded?
It was recorded in the Becker County records.
And would they find that on a title search? Like how would Respondents Council find that in the recording?
Yes, it would. It did appear actually in the title search. I don't know if we cited to that portion of the record. I know that it was before the district court that there had been a title search done, and it did appear that the lease was there.
Okay, thank you.
Minnesota law is crystal clear on this point. A purchaser in good faith is one who gives valuable consideration without actual implied or constructive notice of inconsistent outstanding rights of others. Thus, if a purchaser has actual implied or constructive notice, the purchaser cannot be a bona fide purchaser. This was well illustrated by the court's opinion in Mid-Country Bank v. Kruger. In that case, the Court of Appeals overturned a district court's finding that a purchaser was a bona fide purchaser because the appellate court determined that the purchaser had constructive notice of the bank's prior mortgage, even though that mortgage had actually been recorded in the wrong place. So when the purchaser in that case did a title search, it didn't turn up. The court still said this constructive knowledge prevents the purchaser from being a bona fide purchaser. The knowledge itself, the constructive knowledge itself, prevented the bona fide purchaser status. Despite this clear law, the district court here wrongly determined that an additional showing of bad faith was required. Minnesota law just does not require an additional showing of bad faith. The purchasing of property with notice of another's outstanding rights is sufficient to demonstrate that the purchaser did not act in good faith. Because McLaughlin had notice of Franklin's right of first refusal when it purchased the property, the district court was wrong in concluding that McLaughlin was a bona fide purchaser and therefore had superior title. And this error of law must be reversed. Second, I want to address the district court erred in determining that the remedy of specific performance was not available to Franklin. The district court acknowledged the correct law, noting that the holder of a right of first refusal may seek specific performance against a purchaser who took title to property in violation of another party's right of first refusal. In fact, under Minnesota law, as well as the law of numerous other jurisdictions, specific performance is generally the correct remedy against a non-bona fide purchaser. But the court wrongly determined that Franklin was not entitled to this remedy because the court determined Franklin had waived its right of first refusal by failing to exercise it within 30 days of learning of the sale.
Let's talk a little bit about that. You know, the lease says you have this timetable. You're arguing they didn't give notice, but yet there's an acknowledgement. I think there's an acknowledgement that by a date of, I don't have the date in front of me, but there is a specific date that your clients knew that this had went down, that this sale had went down. So at that point, rather than stepping up and saying, wait a minute, we have a right of first refusal, there was emails or there was apparently some negotiations on trying to just remedy it and continue with the leasing. So how do you explain how you responded and announced your right of first refusal when that hadn't explicitly taken place?
So, Your Honor, the right of first refusal was breached at the time that the notice was not given. So when about the sale, at that point, because its right had already been breached, it was excused from performing under that contract by exercising its right. And in fact, the only time limitation on Franklin at that point.
Don't you have to do something? And I'm saying just for lawful purposes, a person, I'm not saying you're, believe me, there's nothing in this record that shows that there was any wrongdoing by anyone. It was a mistake. Everybody thought, everybody knew. But my point is this, is a person that has a right of first refusal could lay in the weeds for 5 years and then say, wait a minute, aha, I didn't have to do anything because I'm excused. The breach already took place. How would you respond to that?
Well, I suppose there might be a latches argument or something at that point, or it may affect what potential remedy was available. I mean, specific performance is an equitable remedy if somebody does wait that long to enforce its rights. However, as a legal matter, a party would be entitled to enforce its right. We have a 6-year statute of limitations on a breach of contract claim here in Minnesota, and that statute of limitations would not have run. Of course, Franklin did not wait that long here, and Franklin did assert its claims here in this court in a timely manner. Cause of action on a violation of a right of first refusal accrues at that time.
Is this something that can survive the summary judgment determination of the court, or is this something that requires further fact-finding or that issues need to be resolved?
Your Honor, there were no disputed facts on this point before the district court. This is an issue that is before Your Honor's de novo, and you can certainly make this determination here based on the undisputed facts before you. In fact, the district court noted that the facts were undisputed. There was no dispute about when
Sometimes a trial court or district court can say there's no disputed facts, but we can perhaps think otherwise.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe McLaughlin has raised any dispute either. They have agreed. I mean, the facts were very clear. The lease was recorded. They received a copy of the lease that was in our addendum with our brief, a copy of that email that they received about 6 weeks before the closing of the sale of the property. The sale occurred in September, and then Franklin learned about the sale in October. All of those facts are very, very clear, very undisputed, and before Your Honor. So I think this court can make a determination about whether or not Franklin waived its right on a de novo review.
What about the question on the tortious interference with the contract? Don't we have some question as to whether McLaughlin intentionally procured the Verbergs to breach the contract? Is that also agreed that didn't happen?
Don't think that is agreed. However, our position is that as a matter of law, based on what Minnesota law requires as a demonstration, the undisputed facts do show that there was intentional interference. And that is the Schumacher v. Erke case. That court stated where a party knows that in order to possess a property, it must interfere with a contract, then intentional interference is established.
How do we know that as a reviewing court? This is summary judgment.
I'm not sure I understand the question. How do you know?
You're arguing that everything is that there's no material issues of any fact questions, and to me it seems to rise to a fact question.
Well, again, Your Honor, it was undisputed that they had knowledge of the contract before proceeding with the purchase. However, you know, to the extent there are any disputed fact questions, then at a minimum, this court should remand for a trial on those issues. The district court was incorrect in just dismissing this matter, right? If there are disputed facts, then summary judgment should not have been granted in McLaughlin's favor. I think, unless the court has any further questions, those are all the points that I wanted to make. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Lucas. You'll have your rebuttal time. Mr. Swanson, the floor is yours.
Thank you, judges, court, counsel. I'm Josh Swanson. I represent the interests of the respondent and appellee McLaughlin's. And I think, Judge Werke, you're 100% right that the court's analysis here starts and stops with the questions of collateral estoppel in res judicata. The court doesn't need to go any further than that. As we've noted in our brief, the Henschel case is entirely distinguishable. There you're dealing with a collision between a car driven by a private citizen, a fire truck, and competing claims and counterclaims between the city who owned the fire truck, the driver of the fire truck, the passenger in the automobile, and the driver of the automobile. That is not the case here. Franklin's claim depends entirely on its lease with the Behrbergs. To get to the McLaughlins and to make any of their claims against the McLaughlins, they have to run through that Behrberg lease. The district court recognized that in both its collateral estoppel analysis and its res judicata analysis. The very same questions that were at issue in Franklin's lawsuit against the Behrbergs, they were the exact same issues in Franklin's claim against the McLaughlins, dealing with the lease between Franklin and the Behrbergs, the right of first refusal between Franklin and the Behrbergs, and the enforceability of that. They were the exact same facts and the exact same issues. Nowhere in the factors for collateral estoppel in res judicata does it say the party's intent is a factor. That's not any, that's nowhere in any of the cases or the analysis of what the court looks at. The factors are for collateral estoppel, is the issue identical to the prior adjudication? We check that box in the Franklin lawsuit against the Behrbergs. It's the exact same issue in the McLaughlin and Franklin lawsuit. Question two, was there a final adjudication?
Also, let me interrupt you here. It seems to me that the claims are different in the sense that Franklin's claim against the Behrbergs stems out of the breach of that lease, which accrues at a different time than the claims against the McLaughlins, which occurred, you know, whatever claim arose out of that occurred when the property transferred.
Well, I think there, Judge, respectfully, we get into the questions of specific performance and the relief they're seeking. McLaughlin's isn't a party to that lease. To get specific performance and compel the remedy they want, which is to exercise the right of first refusal in purchasing the property, that's what Franklin wants. To get to that, they need to prevail on a claim against the Behrbergs under that lease.
I think they have to prevail on the idea that that your clients were not bona fide purchasers. And so did they have knowledge, constructive or real knowledge, you know, of this term of the lease?
Sure. And they did have knowledge of it. I do concede that. But I think Judge Werke is right on the estoppel. And I'll say this with respect to that knowledge.
So if you concede that, do you concede they're not a bona fide purchaser?
I don't concede that at all, because the right of first refusal in that contract term, it doesn't create any affirmative duties where McLaughlin has to seek Franklin out on that. As the court noted, the district court noted, Franklin knew that McLaughlin's had purchased the property in October of 2021. That's that email between Franklin and McLaughlin. Not only did they know about it when the complaint was served on Franklin April of 2022, Franklin received a copy of the trust deeds deed here. In January 2023, in discovery, Franklin received a copy of the actual purchase agreement. So under the best day for Franklin, they not only knew that there was a sale, they knew the exact and specific terms of that sale in January 2023. Under the language in paragraph 7 in the lease with respect to the right of first refusal, Franklin had 30 days to exercise it. It's their burden. It's incumbent upon them.
Franklin
can't say.
I think the term of the lease says Franklin has 30 days upon receiving written notice of the sale. And I don't see anything in the record anywhere that they received written notice from the Vandenbergs that this was happening.
Well, I don't know that I would agree with that. I know at the district court, Judge Schmidt, the issue came up and it was argued and briefed to the district court on that very point, that when Franklin received the purchase agreement in January 2023, they certainly had written notice of the sale. The properties defined in the purchase agreement provided to Franklin, the purchase price of $495,000 is identified in that purchase agreement. The parties are identified. Every material term is provided in that writing, in that purchase agreement. Franklin had that in January of 2023.
And that is after the sale, right?
That is after the sale. But I think when we take a look at that here, is the court really going to require parties to say, okay, now we're going to reverse all this, despite the fact the lease has expired. The lease
occurs after the sale, the whole purpose of a right of first refusal is that a sale has not occurred. And so by the plain language of that term, they're supposed to get notice before the sale.
But I think at that point, if that's how the court interprets it, I think it overlooks the fact that Franklin had not just actual notice of the sale, they certainly had written notice of every material term, and then they just waited and sat on it.
Their notice all came after the sale, right?
It did come after the sale, and I think we might be at the point where I think it's bad law, especially with respect to contracts and right of first refusals. In a state like Minnesota, with a lot of agricultural lands that have options or right of first refusals, if the court says, if you have a right of first refusal and you have knowledge that the party has sold the property, that you can just sit there and do nothing, despite the fact that you know of the sale, you know about the terms of the sale, and sit on your hands and take no action to exercise that right. It's undisputed that at no point did Franklin say, we are exercising that right of first refusal. That was admitted by both Franklin and Anderson in their depositions. They never exercised it. It'd be a different situation factually if Franklin would have said, once they received a copy of the purchase agreement in January 2023, we're exercising our right. They didn't do that. I think that awards bad behavior on the behalf of a party who has a right of first refusal, and it sets a dangerous precedent for the court when dealing with other contracts, where if a party with the right of first refusal literally knows every single term, knows what's in the purchase agreement, knows the purchase price, and they just sit there and take what I would argue is a hyper-technical reading of paragraph 7. Under paragraph 7, what that right of first refusal, I would argue, is intended to do is to let Franklin know that the Vandenbergs are looking at selling the property.
Which they got notice of after the sale. And that's the problem. Timing here matters. Notice occurred after the sale, that's problematic for the right of first refusal. So let me flip what you're saying on its head and ask you, what did your clients do? Because this was recorded. When it comes to the title search, did they do anything to make sure that the right of first refusal had been is taken care of, that it's not an issue in this sale?
Sure. And that's not in the record, right? What the district court judge, Judge Stillman, held was that Franklin has offered no evidence to show that McLaughlin was a bad faith purchaser. They knew of the lease, but there's no evidence it's not self-executing. Franklin has to exercise it. But two, importantly, the lease doesn't prohibit the sale of the property. The lease doesn't say that the Vandenbergs can't sell the property, right? So I don't think it's incumbent upon McLaughlin to go out and say to Franklin, did you exercise that? Even if it were, we know by that email that's part of the record, that October 21st or 20th, 2020 email that Judge Werke cited to, we know at that point that Franklin is communicating with McLaughlin saying, we would like to lease this property. We know you bought it. We're interested in discussing a lease with you. At no point did they say, we're going to exercise our right of first refusal. We're going to buy that property. It's difficult to envision a factual situation where Franklin is discussing the lease with McLaughlin, which we know they are in October 2021. And Franklin's not saying, look, there's this right of first refusal. We're going to exercise it. That's not what they said. They said, we want to keep discussing this lease. So I don't think
because at that point, but at that point, the right of first refusal had already been breached. That term had been breached. So why would Franklin have to exercise a term?
With Franklin, they don't have to show that McLaughlin breached the lease. McLaughlin's not a party to it. To get to that specific performance under Clause 7, they have to get the remedy of specific performance against Franklin. That's exactly what was at issue, as the district court found in Verberg's suit with McLaughlin, or excuse me, Verberg's suit with Franklin. And it's the exact same issue that was involved in Franklin's lawsuit with McLaughlin. And I think the timing here is indicative of that fact. McLaughlin sued Franklin in April 2022. Franklin brought a motion to dismiss. The district court ruled on that motion to dismiss, I believe it was on September 28, 2022. The very next day, literally the very next day, Franklin sued Verberg, bringing the same claims of its right of specific performance under that lease. The remedy that Franklin seeks, the issue is the exact same. It's identical in both cases. Can Franklin exercise that right of first refusal in the lease? They settled those claims in the lawsuit against Verberg. And with respect to the idea that a settlement can operate as an adjudication on the merits, that's not what the case law says. Goldberger is instructive on that. It talks about a judgment based on a settlement agreement is a final judgment on the merits with respect to those issues and claims settled. What was settled in the Verberg lawsuit? Franklin's rights under the 2006 lease. What's at issue in the lawsuit with McLaughlin? Franklin's rights under the 2006 lease. And with respect to the remedy issue,
I want to turn your attention to a portion of this matter that I find interesting. This, of course, these are all summary judgment determinations by the court. And certainly you want us to affirm the district court's determination on the tortious interference. Why is there not an issue that should be determined by either a court trial or a jury trial on tortious interference?
I think the answer to that, Judge Werke, is that neither party argued there are questions of facts, and Franklin in their appeal, and even at the district court, they didn't say in response to McLaughlin's motion for summary judgment on the tortious interference, a slander title, Franklin didn't say to the district court or argue there's fact questions here that preclude summary judgment. So the procedural posture this gets to the court on is that both parties agree there are no facts in dispute. And I think critically, the district court also held with respect to the tortious interference and slander of title claims that Franklin failed to satisfy the elements of making a prima facie case. The court went on, quote, there is no evidence in the form of emails, affidavits, deposition testimony, or otherwise showing a representative of McLaughlin's intended to procure a breach between the Verbergs and Franklin and that they did so without justification. I think pages 11 and 12 of the order, the district court looks at that. And I would agree with you. I think if it were me making the argument, I mean, I don't want a Monday morning quarterback it, but I think had I been the one facing bringing the tortious interference claim and slander of title, what I probably would have argued is, Judge, this is a fact question. We need a trial on this. That's not what Franklin did. And I think now this court has to accept the case as it got to them and can't send it back to the district court when Franklin, to the extent there were any fact questions, they've waived those. And I think it's also important to note that the district court said they didn't meet the factors or criterion for making the prima facie a case with respect to that. So in conclusion, what I would say is this: a ruling on behalf of Franklin sets a very dangerous precedent that a party can engage in a type of gamemanship where they bring multiple lawsuits. They have a counterclaim against McLaughlin's. Then they bring a lawsuit against Verbergs for the exact same thing. They could have moved to consolidate them under the rules. They could have brought a third party claim against Verberg in the Franklin lawsuit. They didn't do that. They chose to try to get two shakes of the dice to prevail. The district court recognized it for what it was and said it was barred. Thank you.
Mr. Swanson, back to you, Ms. Lucas.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to start where I think Mr. Swanson left off with regard to whether or not we argued down below that there were disputed issues of material fact on tortious interference. Mr. Swanson is simply incorrect. That's a misrepresentation of the arguments that we made. While we did state that we argued that it was clear, the facts were undisputed, and as a matter of law, the court could determine that tortious interference had occurred. We also argued in the alternative, to the extent that the court found disputed facts, then those should be left for trial on the issue.
Would you assert are the disputed facts then?
I presume whether or not there was intentional interference. Based on the Schumacher case, we think that was demonstrated as a matter of law. But to the extent the district court determined that additional facts were required on that factor, then those would be disputed facts, whether or not there was intentional interference.
What I'm getting at is, doesn't somebody need to say, look, this is what's in dispute to survive summary judgment? And it looks like nobody did.
I disagree, Your Honor. In our summary judgment briefing, as I recall, we did argue that if the court did not find that this occurred as a matter of law, then it was a disputed fact. I also want to address what Mr. Swanson said regarding the motion to dismiss and the failure to join Verbergs in either the action against McLaughlin or join McLaughlin in the action against Verberg. As he noted, the case against Verberg was filed right after the motion to dismiss was granted or was denied. I apologize. The grounds for that motion to dismiss were failure to join an indispensable party. And so Franklin had argued that Verberg should have been a party to this case, and the district court disagreed and told Franklin to go and file a separate action against Verberg. So that is what occurred. I just wanted to correct what I felt like was something of a misrepresentation as to how that occurred. I also want to address Mr. Swanson's assertion that Franklin sat on its rights. He noted that Franklin did not receive a copy of that purchase agreement until January 2023. That was 8 months after Franklin had already brought its claims against McLaughlin. This lawsuit was pending. They didn't receive that information until the matter was in discovery. So to assert that after it had already asserted its cause of action and they'd been litigating the matter for 8 months, then Franklin was required to exercise its right of first refusal, that just doesn't really make any sense here. I also want to address Mr. Swanson's assertion that Franklin never asserted his right of first refusal as against McLaughlin. In fact, I believe on December 2nd, Franklin emailed McLaughlin in part of their discussions about whether or not they could resolve this dispute by simply extending the lease, and told McLaughlin quite clearly that they had a right of first refusal that they would consider trying to enforce if they couldn't reach agreement here on a continued leasing of the property. So again, I believe that was a misrepresentation of what was in the record. I also want to address Mr. Swanson's claims about the Henschel case and his attempts to distinguish it based on the facts. While it's true it involved an automobile accident, the relevant facts there were that the city brought claims against both the driver of the automobile and the owner of the automobile. The claims were the same. They were for negligence. They were for workers' comp costs. They were for damage to the city's vehicle. The city settled those claims against the owner of the car and wanted to maintain its action against the driver of the car. And that was where the district court had dismissed the case against the driver of the car based on the settlement that the city reached with the owner. In terms of whether the claims were similar, what the parties intended in settling with with one party versus the other. All of those matters are fully on point with what we have in front of us here. As Judge Smith noted, the claims here against McLaughlin and against Franklin are different, right? I'm sorry, against McLaughlin and the Verbergs are different. The claims against the Verbergs, breach of contract. The claims against McLaughlin, purchasing of the property in violation of the right of first refusal as a non-bona fide purchaser, as well as tortious interference. Those are separate claims. Franklin was entitled to settle its claims against Verberg without affecting its claims against McLaughlin. Unless your honor has any other questions, I will rest my time. Thank you.
There's none. Thank you again to both attorneys for appearing on our Zoom platform. The matters were well briefed and well argued. The matter is taken under advisement and a decision will be issued in the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.